with what he had said under oath to Victor Warheide, that the first time that it ever clicked that there might have been a discussion regarding a boxing team trip to Russia had been in midsummer, during the Article 32 hearing. I also found it curious that later in these notes, while describing the attack by the four assailants, McDonald had written, as he had told Dr. Sadoff in Philadelphia in April of 1970, "I suppose it's possible she, the female intruder, was a male with long hair. CID never asked me if it was possible she was male." In late afternoon, I would drive to Terminal Island. I would sit with McDonald for 2 or 3 hours each evening in the visitor's lounge. Most nights his mother was present. Occasionally, when her airline work schedule permitted, Candy Kramer would be there also. Often, friends and colleagues from St. Mary's came to call. McDonald would talk about the horrors of his cross-country bus trip, of the evil personified by such figures as Dupree, Murtaugh, and the Kassabs, of the failure of the jury selection process and of Bernie Siegel's closing argument, of how, despite it all, he could not understand how the jury could not have at least found reasonable doubt. When the visit was over, I would stop and get a bite to eat. Then I would return to the condominium. He never came right out and asked me what I thought, and I never came right out and said. For him, it must have seemed easier to assume that with me his innocence had never been in question. To ask directly would have been to risk getting an answer he did not want. For me, of course, it was easier to let him go right on believing whatever he cared to believe. At least it seemed so at the time. The more I learned, the less easy any of it turned out to be. There was no dearth of enlightening material in the files. One folder marked book contained a copy of a letter that Joseph Wambaugh had written to McDonald on March 28, 1975, in response to an inquiry about whether Wambaugh might be interested in writing a book about the case. This was only 2 months after McDonald had been indicted. "You should understand that I would not think of writing your story. It would be my story. Just as The Onion Field was my story, and In Cold Blood was Capote's story. We both had the living persons sign legal releases, which authorized us to interpret, portray, and characterize them as we saw fit, trusting us implicitly to be honest and faithful to the truth as we saw it, not as they saw it. With this release, you can readily see that you would have no recourse at law if you didn't like my portrayal of you. Let's face another ugly possibility. What if I, after spending months of research and interviewing dozens of people and listening to hours of court trials, did not believe you innocent? I suspect that you may want a writer who would tell your story, and indeed your version may very well be the truth, as I would see it. But you'd have no guarantee, not with me. You'd have absolutely no editorial prerogative. You would not even see the book until publication." The next day, McDonald had sent a brief note to Bernie Siegel, along with a copy of Wambaugh's letter. "Enclosed is very interesting. What do you think? He sounds awfully arrogant to me, but it will be an obvious bestseller if he writes the book. Please get back to me ASAP." Wambaugh, of course, had not written the book, though his discussions with McDonald and Bernie Siegel had continued into the summer of 1979. Now I was writing it. As would have been the case with Wambaugh, McDonald had absolutely no editorial prerogative, and the ugly possibility to which Wambaugh had referred had now become a reality. I found in the files a program from an athletic event, the Long Beach Heart Association's second annual benefit basketball classic, April 11, 1975, played at the Long Beach City College Gymnasium. The classic consisted of a game between a team composed of Los Angeles Rams football players and one which consisted of emergency room physicians and technicians from various Long Beach hospitals. At guard, number 7, age 31, height 5 feet 10 and a half inches, weight 185 pounds, was Jeffrey R. McDonald, M.D. Beneath his name and picture in the program was a caption which he had written himself, The Second Coming of Dr. J. Watch His Hands. This had appeared just 3.5 months after MacDonald had been indicted on charges of having murdered his pregnant wife and 2 daughters with his hands. An extensive study of the narcissistic personality disorder has been made by psychoanalyst Otto Kernberg, who published many of his findings in a 1975 volume entitled Borderline Conditions and Pathological Narcissism. On the surface, Kernberg writes, pathologically narcissistic individuals may not present seriously disturbed behavior. Some of them may function socially very well. Many possess the capacity for active, consistent work in some area, which permits them partially to fulfill their ambition of greatness and of obtaining admiration and approval from other people. Kernberg has observed a curious apparent contradiction between a very inflated concept of themselves and an inordinate need for tribute from others. When narcissistic personalities are in a position of objective importance, they love to surround themselves with admirers in whom they are interested as long as the admiration is new. They obtain very little enjoyment from life other than from the tributes they receive from others or from their own grandiose fantasies, and they feel restless and bored when external glitter wears off and no new sources feed their self-regard. Kernberg considers the main characteristics of narcissistic personalities to be grandiosity, extreme self-centeredness, and a remarkable absence of interest and empathy for others, in spite of the fact that they are so very eager to obtain admiration and approval. It is as if they feel they have the right to control and possess others and to exploit them without guilt feelings, and behind a surface which very often is charming and engaging, one senses coldness and ruthlessness. These patients not only lack emotional depth, but fail to understand complex emotion in other people. Kernberg has noted that the pathological narcissist experiences other people as basically dishonest and unreliable. The greatest fear of these patients is to be dependent on anybody else, because to depend means to hate, envy, and expose themselves to the danger of being exploited, mistreated, and frustrated. Conversely, however, such individuals experience a remarkably intense envy of other people who seem to have things they do not have, or who simply seem to enjoy their lives. Such a devalued concept of self, Kernberg has observed, can be seen especially in narcissistic patients who divide the world into famous, rich, and great people on the one hand, and the despicable, worthless mediocrity on the other. Such patients are afraid of not belonging to the company of the great, rich, and powerful, and of belonging instead to the mediocre, by which they mean worthless and despicable, rather than average in the ordinary sense of the term. Narcissistic patients, Kernberg continues, possess an overriding necessity to feel great and important in order to cancel feelings of worthlessness and devaluation. At the very bottom of this dichotomy lies a still deeper image of the relationship with external objects, precisely the one against which the patient has erected all these other pathological structures. It is the image of an enraged, empty self, the hungry wolf out to kill, eat, and survive, full of impotent anger at being frustrated, and fearful of a world devoid of food and love, which seems as hateful and revengeful as the patient himself. Kernberg cites the case of one patient who fell in love with a woman whom he considered very beautiful, gifted, warm, in short, completely satisfying. He had a brief period of awareness of how much he hated her for being so perfect, just before she responded to him and decided to marry him. After their marriage, he felt bored with her and became completely indifferent toward her. After that, the patient gradually developed strong hatred toward her for having all that he felt he did not have. One evening at Terminal Island, MacDonald gave me a letter which he had just received from his brother. At the risk of losing your eternal friendship, I'm going to ask you point blank if you killed your wife and daughters. And if you don't want to answer the question, then it's still all right with me. But the question is one that has been gnawing at me since 1971, and I feel that at least to ask the question would be to unburden my mind. But then, of course, I immediately lose your respect by even thinking of asking the question. But since you think that I have a mental problem, I think that one way of me helping myself is to unload those questions which I know have been bothering me. I have to assume that the answer is, no, I did not kill my wife or either of my daughters, and if such is the case, then I can rest assuredly. But then the problem is, why are you there? If you're not guilty, then you don't belong in jail. If you don't belong in jail and are in jail, then something is terribly wrong. If something is wrong, what and why and how can we remedy the situation? I'm sorry to even consider asking the question, but since 1970, I've been answering questions from many people, and I've always asked them, have you ever asked him, you, did you kill your wife and or daughters? And no one ever said that they had asked you. So if anyone ever asks me again, I can say, yes, I asked him, and he said, A, yes, B, no, C, Fifth Amendment, D, other, E, blank. You fill it in. Jay had enclosed a stamped, self-addressed envelope for reply, but Jeff told me that, of course, he had no intention of replying. Laughing, he said this was just one more example of how mentally disturbed his brother continued to be. Kernberg has found that the narcissist's haughty, grandiose, and controlling behavior, particularly the excessive demandingness, the arrogant and exploitative relationships these patients develop with women, is a defense against the projection of rage. Under most circumstances, Kernberg makes clear, narcissistic character defenses protect the patient against the intensity of his rage. And because of the narcissist's superficially smooth and effective social adaptation, the serious distortion in his internal relationship with other people may come as a real surprise. Indeed, it has been Kernberg's observation that the transformation of a previously bland, mostly indifferent, apparently well-controlled narcissistic personality into an openly raging person may be quite striking. He notes also, however, that aggressive outbursts, quick flare-ups, and subsequent dispersal of emotion do occur, particularly under conditions when the narcissist feels superior to or in control of those against whom his rage is directed. At the condominium, I came across an article entitled Dangerousness, Diagnosis, and Disposition, written in 1968 by a Philadelphia psychiatrist named Melvin S. Heller and presented to a conference of trial judges. There was nothing to indicate why McDonald had acquired a copy of the article or why he had retained it for so long, but certain passages did not seem entirely irrelevant. Violence may be meted out in a controlled, measured fashion, Dr. Heller wrote, or in an uncontrolled, blind rage, in which event the instinctual discharge of primitive, aggressive impulses is prominent. Further on, calling attention to man's genius for deception, he stated, in view of man's capacity for inappropriate and unexpected violence, especially when planned behind the camouflage of smiles and flattery, the prognosis of dangerousness requires sophisticated judgment, clinical experience, and an intimate knowledge of the individual and his milieu. I then found the one document which, during trial, Bernie Siegel had not permitted me to see, the report of the prosecution psychiatric team, based upon their examination of McDonald in August. Though he had not permitted psychiatric testimony at the trial, Judge Dupree had made reference to this report in his denial of bail, writing that it tends to indicate that the defendant does indeed possess those traits of character which are consistent with his commission of the crimes with which he is charged, and that he possesses other traits which tend to cast serious doubt on the credibility of his explanation of how the crimes occurred. Their first look at the report had left Siegel shaken, and McDonald angrier than he had been at any other time during the trial. Reading it now, 3 months later, with the sun shimmering on the water behind the sliding glass doors, I could see why. The report, signed by the examining psychologist, Hirsch Lazar Silverman, of South Orange, New Jersey, began by describing MacDonald as a man unhappily confused about his own masculinity, and said, "His thought processes are distinctly marked with unconscious feelings of considerable inadequacy, in great part consciously and deliberately concealed by a facade of assertiveness which he confuses with manliness." It said, "There seems to be an absence in him of deep emotional response, coupled with an inability to profit from experience. He is the kind of individual who is subject to committing asocial acts with impunity. He lacks a sense of guilt. He seems bereft of strong conscience, and he appears incapable of emotionally close or mutually cooperative relationships with women." Derivatively, he apparently avoided, even resented, the demands on him to fulfill the responsibilities of having been a husband and a father of female children. Parenthood, for him, may have been viewed as threatening and potentially destructive. The report also said, "He is subject to being amnesic concerning what he would wish to blot out from his consciousness and very conscience. His credibility leaves much to be desired. In testing, he proved himself to be considerably pathological and impulsive, with feministic characteristics and concealed anger. He has a disdain for others with whom he differs, and he is subject to respond with anger when his person is questioned, on whatever basis. He handles his conflicts by denying that they even exist. He is not in touch with his feelings, and essentially is not comfortable with himself. He has only an authoritarian image of himself as the machismo type of male. In terms of mental health and personality functioning, he is either an overt or a repressed sexual invert, characterized by expansive egotism and delusions of persecution. He is preoccupied with the irrelevant and is unable to face reality. To suit his whims, he has the faculty to manufacture and convolute circumstances. He seeks attention and approval, and is given to denial of truth." The report continued, "The inanimate movement responses in his Rorschach indicate latent homosexuality, approaching homosexual panic, and the depreciated female contents in his projections suggest more than a possibility of homosexuality, latent or otherwise. The animal content in the Rorschach further indicates homicidal tendencies." In summary, the report stated, "Dr. MacDonald may well be viewed as a psychopath subject to violence under pressure, rather effeminate as an individual, and given to overt behavior when faced with emotional stress. There is also, however unclear, a fear in him of what he is subject to do with his hands. In essence, Dr. MacDonald is in need of continuous, consistent psychotherapeutic intervention, coupled with psychiatric attention." Kernberg has found narcissistic patients to be filled with intense hatred and fear of the image of a dangerous, aggressive mother, a fear which, he says, represents a projection of his own aggression, linked to the rage caused by his frustration by mother. "The narcissist's ideal concept of himself," Kernberg writes, "is a fantasy construction which protects him from such dreaded relationships with all other people, and also contains a helpless yearning and love for an ideal mother who would come to his rescue. Should such a dreaded relationship, such as marriage, materialize, the complex defense mechanism which has been constructed within the psyche of the pathological narcissist would come under severe stress because, as Christopher Lash notes, such a person perceives the female, child or woman, wife or mother, as a monster who cuts men to ribbons or swallows them whole. Thus, in Lash's view, fear of the devouring mother of the pre-Oedipal fantasy gives rise to a generalized fear of women, and this fear, closely associated with a fear of the consuming desires within, reveals itself as a boundless rage against the female sex." On the afternoon of April 6, 1970, Grebner and Ivory and Shaw were questioning MacDonald about a white terrycloth bathrobe which had been found with blades of grass adhering to the bottom, as if someone had worn it outdoors when the grass was wet, and had, perhaps, squatted briefly to place a paring knife and an ice pick side by side beneath a bush. Did you put on that terry robe at any point in the evening? No. Did you ever wear it outside? The robe? Yes. Well, maybe to run to get something off the line, you know, or pick up the paper every morning, but not specifically, no. Now, sometimes, you know, maybe the kids would dress up in those things and go outdoors and play for a minute, but that was considered good stuff, and my mother, that's a Freudian slip, my wife would have, you know, called them back in and taken it off. A Freudian slip. Not dissimilar, perhaps, from the other unconscious errors he had made during the April 6th interview, when three times he had said bed instead of couch in describing where his struggle against the intruders had taken place. On my last day at the condominium, I found more pages of notes in Jeffrey McDonald's handwriting. The heading said, Activities, Monday, 16 February, 5:30 p.m., Tuesday in hospital, 17 February. This, too, was part of the detailed account which McDonald had prepared at the request of his military attorney immediately after the April 6th announcement that he was being held as a suspect. The account which, he had told Victor Warheide at the grand jury, he had put in writing because the events were too painful for him to talk about. This, he had told Warheide, was the most accurate, most complete, most coherent account of the night of the murders which he had ever compiled. He had not, however, made it available to Warheide or to the grand jurors. He had not made it available to any investigator. He had given it to his lawyers for their use, not knowing at the time what the evidence against him might consist of. And once it became clear, during the Article 32 hearing, that certain avenues were not to be pursued, this most accurate account had lain at the bottom of a cardboard box, covered by dozens of other files. With the warm Southern California sun of late November shining brightly through the sliding glass doors, I started to read. We ate dinner together at 5:45 p.m., all four. It is possible I had one diet pill at this time. I do not remember, but it is possible. I'd been running a weight control program for my unit, and I put my name at the top of the program to encourage participation. I had lost 12 to 15 pounds in the prior 3 to 4 weeks in the process, using 3 to 5 capsules of Escitrol Spansuel, 15 milligrams dextroamphetamine, speed, and 7.5 milligrams prochlorperazine, compazine, to counteract the excitability of the speed. I was also losing weight because I was working out with the boxing team, and the coach told me to lose weight. In any case, the reason I could have taken the pill was twofold. One, to eat less in the evening when I snacked the most, and two, to try to stay awake after dinner since I was babysitting. It didn't work if I did take a pill, because I think I had a 1/2 hour nap on the floor from 7:30 to 8 p.m. after I put Christy to bed. The CID knows nothing about the possible diet pill. If I did take the pill, it is conceivable that my urine and blood, 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, would still have some residue. We would have to research the breakdown and excretion of what was in the pill. We would also have to find out if the excretion products are definitely different than normal breakdown products of adrenaline from the body, which would be increased in the excitement of the attack, etc. Right now, I don't know if it is definitely possible to identify dextroamphetamine from pills in the blood and the urine. I think I told the CID the only pills I usually took were aspirin, occasional cold pills, and tetracycline, antibiotic. Dr. Henry Ashton, now living in Salt Lake City, Utah, was the group surgeon before I arrived in September 1969. If he remembers, he can testify that the bottle of Escitrol from my house, with only a few missing, was left in the desk I took over when he left. If necessary, we can then contact the Smith, Klein, and French representative near here who can testify I never received another large bottle of sample Escitrol. He did give me some small sample bottles for use in the weight control program. Colette had some diet pills of her own, used before she was pregnant. I think I threw them all out because they made her nervous. but possibly there was an old container left in the medicine cabinet. Having received a report from the Fort Gordon Laboratory that an analysis of Jeffrey McDonald's blood, made from a sample taken at 11:40 a.m. on February 17th, did not reveal the presence of any dangerous drugs or narcotics, Franz Josef Grebner and all subsequent investigators had simply assumed, with some justification, that Jeffrey McDonald's drug consumption had not been a factor in the commission of the murders. An examination I made subsequently of the laboratory notes compiled by the Fort Gordon chemist who had actually performed the tests on McDonald's blood, however, revealed that no attempt was ever made to determine from the sample whether Jeffrey McDonald, in the hours or days that had immediately preceded the murders, had been ingesting amphetamines. The chemist had never been instructed to test for the presence of amphetamines, and in fact, the equipment available at the CID laboratory at the time would not have enabled him to do so. In 1970, these drugs were widely prescribed and were consumed in considerable quantity, not only by individuals attempting to lose weight, but by students, truck drivers, and physicians, who found it necessary to remain awake and alert for extended periods of time. In 1970, amphetamines were not considered a dangerous drug by military authorities attempting to combat a dramatic upsurge in the use both of hallucinogens and of opiates such as heroin, and chiefly concerned with the widespread use of marijuana. 10 years later, however, the potential hazards associated with Escitrol consumption had received considerably wider attention. The drug is listed in Pills That Don't Work, the 1981 book by Sidney M. Wolfe, M.D., and Christopher M. Coley, that is described on its cover as a consumer's and doctor's guide to over 600 prescription drugs that lack evidence of effectiveness. Wolfe and Coley described the drug as not only ineffective, but also dangerous. To use a combination of an upper and a downer, both of which carry significant risks, is asking for trouble. Among the possible side effects listed are insomnia, restlessness, nervousness, and dizziness. The authors also state that psychosis, insanity, may occur with large doses. Escitrol is described in even more detail in the Physician's Desk Reference, a standard medical reference book published by Medical Economics Company. Amphetamines have a significant potential for abuse, the text states, in view of their short-term anorectic effects and rapid development of tolerance. They should be used with extreme caution and only for limited periods of time in weight reduction programs. According to his own notes, the notes which Victor Warheide had asked him to provide to the grand jury, but which he had declined to do, the notes which had lain in the bottom of a file drawer since 1970, when McDonald had learned that CID testing had failed to discover the presence of amphetamines in his blood, McDonald had lost 12 to 15 pounds in the 3 to 4 weeks preceding the murders. That was a lot of weight to lose for an already fit 26-year-old Green Beret officer, fresh from paratroop training in Fort Benning. And boxing would not account for it. His last workout with the boxing team had come more than 3 weeks before the killings. Neither would an odd hour of basketball late on a rainy afternoon produce that sort of weight loss. And there had been nothing to suggest that McDonald had embarked upon a formal diet. Indeed, he'd been eating cookies with Ron Harrison on the night of Valentine's Day and drinking a sweet liqueur with his wife 2 nights later, and, he had said, one of the most appealing features of Hamlet Hospital was that the nurses served him steak for breakfast. 3 to 5 Escitrol spanules over a 3 to 4 week period also would not have accounted for the weight loss. 3 to 5 per day, however, could have had a marked effect. That level of consumption could also have had a number of other consequences, such as, according to the Physician's Desk Reference, marked insomnia, tenseness and irritability, hyperactivity, confusion, assaultiveness, hallucinations, panic states, and, the most severe, psychosis. Cardiovascular reactions, the reference book states, may include chilliness, pallor, or headache, all three of which symptoms Jeffrey MacDonald exhibited in the immediate aftermath of the murder of his family. And it is not only the amphetamine component which can pose hazards. Again, as cited in the physician's desk reference, prochlorperazine, the sedative component of the spansule, can cause agitation, restlessness, and reactivation of psychotic processes. The physician's desk reference also states that the drug was so prepared that an initial dose is released promptly and the remaining medication is released gradually over a prolonged period. The prescribed dose was one capsule per day to be taken in the morning. If appetite control is desired through evening hours, the PDR states, shift dose to mid-morning. Late afternoon or evening medication should be avoided because of the resulting insomnia. Yet Jeffrey MacDonald, outstanding medical student though he had been, was consuming the drug in a manner contrary to this recommendation. How much he might have been consuming will forever be, to employ a phrase used by Freddie Kassab before the grand jury, a dark area. But if the 3 to 5 were a daily dose, it would have been enough, taken over a period of 3 to 4 weeks, to have caused chronic amphetamine psychosis, many of the symptoms of which MacDonald did, in fact, display. In the hospital after the murders, he also displayed symptoms associated with abrupt cessation of high dosages of the drug, such as cited in the PDR, extreme fatigue and mental depression. The chapter on amphetamines in Disposition of Toxic Drugs and Chemicals in Man by Randall C. Baselt, Biomedical Publications, 1982, states that chronic usage is associated with a high incidence of weight loss, hallucinations, and paranoid psychosis. An even more detailed analysis of the effects of amphetamines and prochlorperazine is contained in Goodman and Gilman's Pharmacological Basis of Therapeutics, a widely used medical text edited by Alfred Goodman Gilman, Lewis S. Goodman, and Alfred Gilman, and published by Macmillan. In the chapter titled Drug Addiction and Drug Abuse, Jerome H. Jaffe, M.D., professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine, writes, "The user of amphetamines is hyperactive, and during a toxic episode may act in response to persecutory delusions. The fully developed toxic syndrome from amphetamine is characterized by vivid visual, auditory, and sometimes tactile hallucinations, such as, one cannot help but wonder, a hallucination involving an attack by 3 armed hippies and a girl with long blonde hair holding a candle and chanting, 'Acid is groovy, kill the pigs.'" Tolerance does not develop to certain of the toxic effects of amphetamines on the central nervous system, Dr. Jaffe writes, and a toxic psychosis may occur after periods of weeks. He also states that the syndrome may be seen as early as 36 to 48 hours after the ingestion of a single large dose. In apparently sensitive individuals, psychosis may be produced by 55 to 75 milligrams of dextroamphetamine. With high enough doses, psychosis can probably be induced in anyone. Other psychopharmacologists have commented that rage reactions are not uncommon in individuals who are abusing amphetamines, particularly when the period of abuse involves sleep deprivation, outside stresses, and most notably, any predisposition toward psychological instability, such as would be the case with an individual suffering from a narcissistic personality disorder. Most observers, Dr. Jaffe writes, have noted considerable psychopathology in compulsive amphetamine users and their families, which appeared to have antedated the drug use. Whether considerable psychopathology existed in the MacDonald family of Patchogue, Long Island, is perhaps another dark area, but it is fact that the father was given to outbursts of anger, and that Jeffrey's only brother was hospitalized after a psychotic episode involving violence. It is also fact that if Jeffrey MacDonald were taking 3 to 5 Escitrol spansules daily, he would have been consuming 75 milligrams of dextroamphetamine, more than enough to precipitate an amphetamine psychosis. Chapter 19, Drug Treatment of Disorders of Mood, of Goodman and Gilman's book, discusses side effects of chlorpromazine, the category of drug which includes the prochlorperazine found in Escitrol spansules. The author, Ross J. Baldassarini, M.D., professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, writes that while tolerance to the sedative effects of this drug develops over a period of days or weeks, it retains a capacity to produce unpleasant side effects, including a syndrome known as akathisia, which is characterized by the compelling need of the patient to be in constant movement. This patient feels that he must get up and walk or continuously move about. Akathisia can be mistaken for agitation in psychotic patients. Certainly, all reports from Womack Hospital indicate that Jeffrey McDonald, in the first moments after his arrival, indeed, until Merrill Bronstein began intravenous administration of Visteril, Nembutal, and Demerol, had felt a powerful urge to get up and walk about, and that he appeared to be in a state of high agitation. Concluding their discussion of Escitrol spansules in Pills That Don't Work, Wolf and Coley wrote that the drug should have been removed from the market long ago. Late in 1980, as such medications were coming under closer scrutiny from the Food and Drug Administration, its manufacturer, Smith, Klein, and French, voluntarily ceased the manufacture and distribution of Escitrol, despite the fact that its estimated retail sales at that time totaled more than $6 million annually. When Colette McDonald, pregnant by accident once again, had left for her psychology class that cold and rainy February evening, her husband, whose pallor, fatigue, and changed personality had been noted even by neighbors in the weeks immediately preceding the murders, had been so exhausted from having worked a 24-hour emergency room shift and then a full day at the office, followed by an hour of basketball and a trip with his daughters to feed the pony, that he had been on the verge of falling asleep without even putting his younger daughter to bed. His condition had been so noteworthy that Colette had commented on it to the friend whom she drove to class. Yet upon her return, he had stayed up with her watching television and sipping Cointreau. And then even when she had gone to bed, he, having lost sexual interest in her since her pregnancy had begun to manifest itself, impotence and change of libido are also among the adverse reactions to consumption of dextroamphetamine, had remained up until 2 a.m. watching the remainder of Johnny Carson and finishing the Mickey Spillane book, Kiss Me Deadly. Even then, McDonald had not been ready for bed. Instead, he said, he had donned a pair of rubber surgical gloves to wash the dishes at 2 o'clock in the morning. This despite his previous state of exhaustion and notwithstanding the fact that he would have to be up again by 7 a.m. to put in another full day at the office. And this also notwithstanding that he had lost 15 pounds in 3 weeks, that he was in the midst of devising a plan which would permit him to spend a fair portion of the late winter and early spring in the vicinity of New York City, where his old, or maybe not so old, girlfriend, Penny Wells, resided, while pregnant Colette cared for the two daughters and the pony, believing him to be in Russia all the while. And all this following an autumn which had brought not only the unexpected pregnancy, but the unexpected breakdown of his older brother, following a period of amphetamine abuse, and such other frustrations as the demotion in authority, if not rank, which had ensued upon the departure of his idol, Colonel Kingston, for Vietnam. He had lost 15 pounds in 3 weeks while taking a drug that can cause insanity. He was suffering from short-term physical exhaustion and longer-term emotional stress. His life, in fact, had been one extended period of stress, financial, intellectual, psychological, ever since Colette had become pregnant and he had had to marry her and to leave Princeton early and to get through medical school while being husband to her and father to two daughters, and the glamour and titillation attendant upon his becoming a Green Beret had provided only a temporary escape. Might it be too much to surmise that since early childhood he had been suffering also from the effects of the strain required to repress the boundless rage which psychological maladjustment had caused him to feel toward child or woman, wife or mother, the female sex. And that on this night, this raw and somber military base February Monday night, finally, with the amphetamines swelling the rage to flood tide, and with Colette, pregnant Colette, perhaps seeking to communicate to him some of her new insights into personality structure and behavioral patterns, indeed, possibly even attempting to explain him to himself, his defense mechanism, for the first and last time, proved insufficient? Would it be too much to suggest that in that one instant, whatever its forever unknowable proximate cause might have been, a critical mass had been achieved, a fission had taken place, and that by 3:40 a.m. on February 17, 1970, the ensuing explosion of rage had destroyed not only Jeffrey McDonald's wife and daughters, but all that he had sought to make of his life? Perhaps. Yet his bloody footprint had been found on the floor, and there were blue threads on the club outside the house, and his wife, already dead or so near to it that the difference was of no import whatsoever, had been stabbed in the chest with an ice pick 21 times after his blue pajama top had been laid across her. And when he had sat down to write the first account of the night's events, knowing that he was now considered the chief suspect, his consumption of a drug which is capable of triggering psychotic rage had been the thing he had felt it necessary to mention first. Chapter 3. Though he had denied it under oath during his grand jury testimony, Jeffrey McDonald had apparently taken a lie detector test during his brief visit to Philadelphia in April of 1970. His own psychiatrist, Dr. Sadoff, had made reference to it during his grand jury testimony and to the fact that McDonald had not come through with flying colors. Home from California, I put the question to McDonald in writing. He responded on a tape from Terminal Island. I guess it was after my psychological interview. Bernie brought up the fact that he wanted me polygraphed. Actually, I guess it was sort of in the middle of these interviews. I felt, sort of hurt. I wondered why he wanted them. And then he explained that perhaps we could use these interviews to head off the Article 32 and the court-martial, that if they came out strong enough, conclusively in my favor, perhaps we could go to the Army with them. I said, fine. If there was a chance for that, we would go ahead and do it. Now, there were two different men. One was John Reed, and the other was Cleve, I think, Baxter. They're both well-known in polygraph fields. These are not lightweights. These were expensive examinations. As I recall it, the first operator was John Reed. He at first seemed very, very professional to me. He explained to me a little bit about the polygraph, what it can and what it can't do, and then proceeded to hook me up to the machine, told me the area of questioning that we would go into, and then he began questioning me. However, when he began questioning me, it seemed to me that he was basically a prosecutor. He was not satisfied with my results. By that, I don't even really know what the results were, but they were not conclusively proving my innocence, and he had a consultation with Bernie. And Bernie, sort of abruptly dismissed him. The results were not conclusive of my innocence. But we moved on because Bernie really wanted a very positive polygraph test. We went on to the second person, who I believe is Cleve Baxter. This is the guy who does the polygraphs and is now famous for polygraphing plants. And he's on Johnny Carson all the time, I believe. In any case, Bernie now spent a lot of time prepping me for this one, saying that this was much more professional, this guy was bigger in his field than Reed, and that I would find him a lot more congenial, and he would treat me a lot better. Well, in fact, just the opposite happened. He basically gave me no prep, except sort of negative type of prep, in which he said that this machine can detect any sort of lying. Well, he hooked me up to the machine, and once Bernie was excused from the room, he began going over my sexual history. It was very bizarre. He started talking about had I ever had sex with women other than Colette, and I answered that. And then he asked, had I ever had sex with men? And then he wanted to know if there was a wild orgy the night of the occurrence of the murders. And I stopped him and I said, I don't understand what we're doing here. I thought this was a polygraph based on my current legal situation. And he says, well, he was just getting me used to the machine and getting a baseline ready on truth and falsity. So I said, okay then, let's get back to the point. So then he said, okay, and we started going back to some more questions, and he immediately reverted to premarital and extramarital sexual activities and unusual sexual activities, and I thought, this guy was crazy, to tell you the truth. And I said, look, I don't think we can continue. And at this point, he made some comment about, well, have you considered the insanity defense? And I said, Jesus, that's the most outrageous thing I ever heard. You haven't even completed your polygraph, and now you're telling me that I should be going for an insanity defense. And he said, well, in his judgment, and he said, basically, I've never been wrong on a major case. You should start considering an insanity defense. When I contacted Cleve Baxter to ask for his recollection of the McDonald polygraph examination, he said he would not be at liberty to discuss it without written authorization from Jeffrey McDonald. When I asked McDonald to provide such authorization, he refused. The fact is, on many tapes, Jeffrey McDonald told me things which, even without the aid of a polygraph, I later determined to be untrue. He recounted, for example, a visit he made to the Fort Bragg boxing team 2 or 3 weeks after I got out of the hospital in 1970. I went over and watched them work out and told them that I'm sorry, I wouldn't be able to go on this trip to Russia. And I found the sergeant who was in charge, and he said he understood completely, and I wished him luck. And as a matter of fact, he started crying while we were talking, and then I started crying. Not only did the boxing coach fail to recall such incident, but the team, as Pruitt and Kearns had determined in 1971, was not even planning a trip to Russia. Once, in discussing Mildred Kassab, McDonald said that after the death of her first husband, she took a boat from San Francisco to Hawaii and was originally planning on going around the world, but ended up staying in Hawaii. And she told me many times, many, many times, both on a couple of occasions when she'd had too much to drink when Colette was alive and she was kind of bragging under the influence of wine, but certainly later on, after the tragedy of 1970, when I was at their house for dinner. She told me in no uncertain terms that the reason she never went around the world was because she was having so much fun in Hawaii and that she had balled every houseboy on the boat going from San Francisco to Hawaii. She then went back to New York, apparently, and lived in the Plaza Hotel for a period of weeks or months, got a good room, and got an excellent table, and had lunch and dinner there every day, waiting to meet the right man. And I think that is how she did meet Freddie Kassab. McDonald's mother, of course, had told the grand jury much the same story, except that in her version, Mildred had gone around the world for a full year, and had then taken up residence in a high-priced New York hotel for 6 additional months, during which time she met Freddie Kassab, who, as McDonald's mother recalled, was from the South. The facts are that for 4 months after her husband's suicide, Mildred Kassab remained with her children. Then, leaving them in the care of her sister Helen, she visited a female friend in California for a week, and then flew to Honolulu, where she remained for 3 weeks. She recalls quite specifically arriving home in time to participate, as a class mother, in a group outing which Colette's elementary school class was making to Ebbets Field to watch the Brooklyn Dodgers play a baseball game. On New Year's Eve of that year, Colette was spending the night at a friend's house, and Mildred, who had at no time taken up residence at the Plaza, was home alone with her son, then 16. Having earlier declined an invitation from friends to attend a New Year's Eve party at a patchogue restaurant called Felice's, Mildred changed her mind in mid-evening, and shortly before midnight, she and her son did join the group, and she attracted the attention of Freddie Kassab, who was there with friends of his own. 3 months later, Kassab managed to arrange an introduction. There was another tape on which McDonald talked at considerable length and in extraordinary detail, about how the night before his wedding he'd had to drive one of the bridesmaids home to New Jersey, but she could not remember where she lived, and they'd become lost for several hours, and as a result, he'd arrived extremely late for his own bachelor party. I wondered at the time why he had bothered to tell it at all. It was not until months later that I learned where he had really been. Back in Patchogue, putting a red and black negligee on the front seat of Penny Wells's car. I finally asked him once about the meeting with Penny Wells at the train station in November of 1969. At first he denied, as he had under oath, that any such meeting had occurred. Then he said, "If it did occur, the most that happened is that I ran across Penny. She may have been working in New York at the time, and we ended up getting off the same train or something like that, and I kissed her hello. If I did see her at the train station, it was absolutely by chance, and this so-called embrace was simply a kiss hello from an old girlfriend to an old boyfriend." I did not even bother to ask him about her meeting him at the airport upon the occasion of his June 1971 arrival in California, because by then I had learned, as had Allard Lowenstein 10 years before, that he'll say anything to anybody. Thus, there had been no making love on the infield of the Saratoga racetrack during Happy Pappy Weekend, or a later spring visit to Skidmore. The Saratoga racetrack is open only during the month of August, at a time when Skidmore is not. And during the 15 days between the completion of his internship and the date of his reporting to Fort Sam Houston, there had been no vacation to an island he thought might have been Aruba. There had been, in fact, only a single weekend between those two phases of his life, a strained and hectic weekend that had been spent moving Colette and the children from the Bergenfield apartment to Patchogue, where they would be spending the summer. There had also been no most memorable lovemaking session on the couch in the living room of the Kassab's Washington Square apartment during Thanksgiving vacation of McDonald's freshman year at Princeton. The Kassab's did not even move to New York City until the summer of the following year. In fact, throughout her freshman year at Skidmore, Colette had not even dated Jeffrey McDonald. She had continued to see her high school boyfriend, Dean Chamberlain. It was not until her sophomore year that she and McDonald resumed their relationship. Thus, the entire vivid recollection of his first days at Princeton and the sudden excitement of having become an Ivy Leaguer and the impulsive decision to pursue a career in medicine, all being intertwined with his receipt of that first titillating letter from Colette and of having rushed with sweaty palms up to Skidmore, is false. A false creation, one might suggest, proceeding from the heat-oppressed brain. Of course, I was not the only one to whom he told stories that were not true. Having his nose broken 4 times in high school, and becoming the first Patchogue High School graduate in more than 20 years to attend an Ivy League college, statements he made to Dr. Sadoff in Philadelphia in April of 1970, these too were false. There was no truth either to the story he told benefactor Bob Stern late one night in August of 1970 toward the end of the Article 32 hearing. This was during the week that the proceedings had been recessed to allow McDonald to undergo psychiatric interview and testing at Walter Reed Hospital in Washington. In the midst of this trip, he had flown to Philadelphia to visit the Sterns for a weekend. At that time, 3 months before he spoke to Freddie Kassab about it on the phone, Jeffrey McDonald told Bob Stern that he had already tracked down and killed one of the hippies who had attacked him and had murdered his wife and children. Gradually, I came to learn things about Jeffrey McDonald from other sources, facts of which not even those who had prosecuted him had been aware. Such as, he had actually made 2 trips to California in the summer of 1971. The first, by plane, was when Penny Wells had met him at the airport. But there had been a second trip after a return to the East when he had moved out to stay. This second trip was made by automobile, and McDonald had been accompanied by a 16-year-old girl, the daughter of family friends from Long Island, whose parents thought she might find it an enriching experience to traverse the United States in the company of the all-American boy they had known so well for so long, and who was struggling so hard now to recover from his recent tragedy. Throughout the journey, all the way from New York to California, Jeffrey McDonald had sexual relations with the 16-year-old girl. I learned also that later that summer, not long after McDonald had taken up residence in Huntington Beach, he received a visit from a close friend of his mother's, a woman he had known since childhood. She brought with her her 10-year-old son. During the course of the visit, which extended over a period of weeks, Jeffrey McDonald had become sexually intimate with his mother's friend. He himself had told me about this during one of my visits to him at Terminal Island. Later, in another part of the country, I located the woman, and she confirmed that the story was true, though she was a bit chagrined that he had chosen to make me aware of it. I asked her what had caused her to terminate the relationship, expecting her to say either that finally the impropriety of the situation had started to bother her, or simply that summer was ending and it was time to go home. Instead, she said she had left abruptly, before she had planned to, because of two incidents involving her 10-year-old son. The first, she said, occurred when McDonald, angered by the boy's misbehavior inside his apartment, had carried him outside and dangled him by the feet over the edge of the dock, threatening to drop him headfirst into the water. The second incident, the woman said, had occurred later in the summer, when she, Jeff, and her son were out for a cruise on his boat. Again, the boy had done something to anger McDonald. This time, the woman said, McDonald had grabbed the boy and had told him, in an even more furious and more threatening tone, that upon returning to shore, he was going to take the boy's head and hold it over the front of the boat and crush his skull against the dock. Eventually, I spoke to the boy, now a young adult attending an Ivy League college, about his recollection of these incidents. "You have to understand," he said, "my parents were divorced, and when I was growing up, I hardly ever saw my father. So Jeff was not just like a friend or even a big brother. Jeff was God to me at that point." In that context, he said, the first incident had not been unduly alarming. Perhaps just a form of roughhousing that had gone a little too far. But the second episode, the scene on the boat, he said, "I remember with real terror to this day." He could not recall what in particular he had done to so anger McDonald, but he came at me yelling, and I remember kind of a fire in his eyes. It really, really was scary. I didn't know what he was going to do. In fact, what he did was to throw me in the water. He threw me off the side of the boat while it was moving, and I can remember actually feeling relieved that he hadn't done anything more. But I will never forget it. I will never forget that look in his eyes. You know, maybe as a kid you perceive things more directly in a way than you do as an adult. But ever since that moment on the boat, I believed that he must have been guilty. Just from seeing that kind of fire in his eyes, and I did not want to stay around him anymore. I was very frightened, and I told my mother I wanted to go home right away. And we did. Chapter 4. On November 27, 1979, lawyers for Jeffrey McDonald filed a brief with the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, in which they renewed their argument that McDonald had been denied his constitutional right to a speedy trial, and in which they also cited instances of what they believed to be grievous error on the part of Judge Dupree. Chief among these was Dupree's decision to exclude from trial the testimony of the individuals with whom Helena Stokely had discussed her possible involvement in the murders. Oral argument on these points was heard by a three-judge panel of the appeals court in Richmond, Virginia, in February of 1980. Considerable attention was focused on the speedy trial claim because it was this which had proved so persuasive in 1976 that a separate panel of the same court had ordered the indictment dismissed. The question of just what was intended by the framers of the Sixth Amendment when they wrote that every accused was entitled to a speedy trial was one which had defied precise judicial analysis for many years. In 1972, however, the Supreme Court had provided four specific criteria for use in the evaluation of such claims. These were length of delay, reason for delay, the defendant's assertion of his right, and whether or not the defendant had been prejudiced by the delay. Prejudice was defined as being